evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, most Sunday evenings, we open up the TechNet. And as you guys probably know by now, the TechNet's main purpose is education. We try very hard to educate each other. This particular repeater has moderately good coverage in the northern New Jersey, western Connecticut, southern New York, Long Island area. So that's the metropolitan New York City area, and there's an awful lot of brain power in there. We try to tap into that brain power. A person, during the first hour, we take in check-ins for people who do have a question or a comment for the net, and we make a sincere effort to at least briefly handle those questions. In theory, then, a person doesn't have to wait for longer than 1 hour to at least get a partial answer to his particular question. As far as the pure ham radio subjects are concerned, let me drop. It quite often involves things like antennas and transmission lines and transmitters and receivers and noise figure and sensitivity and propagation. And there's 26 different kinds of ham radio. So if the kind that you're using right now, FM 2-meter repeater ham radio, is not completely pleasing to you before you completely give up this very educational hobby, try one of the other 25 is a very good suggestion. For the last 6 years, the TechNet has been recorded, and all of those recordings exist on a website. And you can get to that website by going to www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Amateurradio.tangovictor. Very enthusiastic guy named Mike Perry, KC2NJI, has been collecting those recordings and documenting those for over 6 years. Starting about 6 months back and all the way back through most of the 6 years, what subject is being discussed during each 10-minute period is documented. So you can look at the master list before you download each one of those one-hour reels and decide whether or not those particular subjects are the ones that you want to listen to. Also, there is some cross-referencing there by which you could choose a particular subject and find out which weekends and which hour of which weekend that particular subject was discussed. Let me drop. You'll find quite a few other pieces of useful information on that amateurradio.tangovictor. From there, you can get yourself a Smith chart. You can also get an article on how to get a perfect impedance match to a Yagi-like antenna or to the driven element of a Yagi antenna or a dipole all by itself. And I think there's some other pieces of, separate articles on the subject of decibels and the Smith chart, as I've mentioned before. You probably know that for the last 6 years, I was getting an awful lot of help from Mel Schneider, K2KEY, and 3 or so weeks ago, Mel became a silent key. And I and many other people are very unhappy about that. He was an extremely useful guy, unusual person who really lived and breathed ham radio almost all of his life, had a very good passion for it, and it was quite a source of information. Mel did have what we now call Mel's Corner, let me drop, by which newer amateurs joining the hobby who didn't yet have a license, couldn't get on the air and talk to us directly on this TechNet, would mail him a question on usually things about how to set up their antennas and transmitters so that they can establish themselves as beginning hams. And so he would get quite a few emails, snail mails, and other per week. On occasional weeks, they went up as high as 300. Not all of them are beginners. He was emphasizing the beginners. John, KC2WGB, has volunteered to try to take over that service. So at the end of the hour, I'll be passing it over to John, where he selects a couple of the, as many as he likes, of the recent emails he has received that we should address. That's what we'll be doing at the end of the hour, and a little bit beyond that, we'll go over to Paul, WS2N, our space expert. He'll tell us what's the latest that National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing. Mel's shoes are going to be very difficult to fill, but as you can tell, we're going to make an attempt. I believe there's going to eventually be a website that you can go to, which will probably be Mel's Corner or technet.limarc.org, something along those lines, by which that information will be collected and disseminated to people who are qualified to give answers. WA5DJB, Kent Britton, who writes lots of articles for CQ and other magazines. He's one of the people who has come forward to volunteer. Looks to me like John's going to be picking up the majority of KC2WGB. Okay, at this time, I'll be taking check-ins. Let me drop. The check-ins are only required to check in if you are a person with a question or a comment. And maybe it's going to be kind of light because this is a holiday weekend, but we need not have thousands of people or hundreds of people or tens of people signing and saying they're listening. This is the 29th year of the Technical Net. This is Technical Net number 1,379 of the series that began in September of 1982. After 29 years, and that particular website has had 138,000 people in many countries who have signed into it, by now we sort of assume that somebody out there is listening. That doesn't have to be confirmed to us anymore. Maybe I'm a little too optimistic, but that's the way we think. A typical sign-in would sound like this. Let me give an example. Kilo Delta 2, Baker Hotel Yankee, James and Yes. In other words, I want call letters, name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. So do we have any check-ins at this time? Please give me your call letters and name. K2RIW, my name is Dick, and I'm listening.
10-2-E-O, Rich and Yes.
We got Rich, number one, on the runway.
K-C-2-Q-F-J.
K-D-2-B-H-Y, yes.
Okay, we got...
N-2-M-D, I have no questions. Request that you have a good evening, sir.
That was Barry. K-C-2-Q-F-J, and I also got James. KD2BHY. I talked to James earlier this week, and I tried playing a little bit of a trick on him. I didn't at first tell him, I told him my call letters, but I said it only phonetically. And at first he didn't know who I was. KC2 Quebec Foxtrot Juliet, please tell me your name right now, sir.
My name is Steven, and I'm coming in through Echolink, so I hope you're copying me okay.
We're copying you very well through Echolink, Steve. So let me think now. Let's see. You're number two. Jim's number three. Barry, right now, doesn't seem to have a question or a comment. Barry, your audio is a little bit muffled. Proper volume, but the high-frequency notes are missing. And I think you're either coming in on Echolink or IRLP. Each time we pass it over to somebody, when we get really rolling, everybody gets quite excited, and we jump on top of each other. Try to leave a space where you do hear all four beep sounds. That allows the whole system of Echolink, IRLP, and everything else to reset correctly. Otherwise, some of the machines get timed out, and people get left out of the conversation. It makes them unhappy. Oh, I also forgot to mention that beyond the first hour, beyond the Mel's mailbag and beyond Paul WS2N's NASA information, after that we get into the deeper subjects. We're going to try to leave a little bit more spaces this time. We're going to also try to give people a little more information as to what the YouTube video or whatever to go to so that they can see the same information we're talking to, the so-called deeper subjects, where we're getting down to the atomic level of electronics and also doing an extended investigation of certain kinds of unusual machines that work with high voltage and arcing. And many of these researchers in Europe believe they have found ways of getting an over-unity machine. In other words, you put in 100 watts and you get 150 watts out of energy lighting light bulbs. They believe they have found machines like that. Of course, many people are very skeptical, but even if it is not a successful endeavor, still, we are studying methods by which measurements are made, and those measurements are quantifiable. Trace
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
And there's an example of something you shouldn't do. Once every minute or so, you should create an interruption, wait for the four beeps, so that the machine doesn't get timed out like I just did. In fact, let me wait one more time to make sure the four beeps are there. Yeah, the investigation on over-unity machines is an ongoing, significant investigation, which, even if it's unsuccessful, still We're teaching each other methods of making quantifiable measurements where those measurements are traceable to the Bureau and therefore subject to peer review and hopefully are more accurate. A number of the techniques that have been used in the past, particularly on magnetic rotary machinery, where various researchers thought they had an over-unity machine, I'm a little bit skeptical of that, and as I know about the unusual kinds of a waveform going into the machine for the current versus voltage relationship and a inverted waveform coming back out of the machine, if you use an ordinary voltmeter and an ordinary current meter, you could be led astray because of these very unusual non-sinusoidal waveforms. It really requires a high-frequency, true RMS voltmeter in order to find out what is the real RMS voltage and RMS current. And if you're trying to assess power input and power output, you also have to know the phase angle between the two. What that watt-hour meter outside of your house does is a lot more magic than first meets the eye. Okay, Rich, N2EO, and Whitestone is the first one. Go right ahead, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNav.
Okay, good evening, Dick. And the TechNav, K2RIW, N2EO. They got a question about parasitic jokes, in particular parasitic suppression that I did on my 6-meter kilowatt that I built. You may recall I took an SB220 low-band amplifier, re-engineered it into a 6-meter amplifier. And when I made the parasitic jokes up, I used the Edisonian approach of cut and try until I get it right. But I really wanted to know what I'm doing with those jokes. What I ended up with, well, first of all, generally they'll use like 2 or 3 turns of wire with usually a 47-ohm 2-watt resistor across the coil to make the parasitic choke. I'm going to reset. Now, I'm trying to understand what those chokes are actually doing, what I was doing. I'm not sure if that resistor is there to lower the Q of the coil, give a very low Q coil, or if it's there to that you get a drop across the coil for the parasitic oscillation and it's absorbed in the resistor like a dummy load. I guess those are two ways of looking at it. But the reason I'm bringing it up, Dick, when I used the 47-ohm resistor, actually I used 3 150-ohm 2-watt resistors in parallel, which was recommended to me. They burnt up no problem. They burnt right up. And I used the Edisonian approach. I ended up using 4,700 ohms, way off value from what you would expect. And it's been running fine for a few months. Doesn't get hot. The chokes don't get hot. The amplifier runs nice and cool. I see no instability problems as I tune through resonance. It's just great. But like I say, I did it with the cut and try method. And I'm trying to understand exactly what I did. The windings I'm using, by the way, are silver-plated strap, 3/10 of an inch in diameter, 2.5 turns, about, oh, I don't know, maybe 3/4 of an inch in diameter of the coil, and each coil is shunted by a 4,700-ohm resistor. Back to net, and to EO.
Now, Rich, was there one single coil across 3 resistors? Or did you have the 3 resistors in series with 3 separate coils, a coil across each resistor? Tell me how you were configuring that, Rich. Go ahead.
Okay, Dick. Well, I did it the way they couldn't get the beep. The way they recommended was 3 resistors in parallel across 1 coil, each per tube, 2 tubes, the 2 parasitic chokes, and the tubes are 3-500.
When we hear destructive behavior, people giving us a dead carrier and or unusual language, do periodically press the reverse button on your transmitter receiver so that you can listen to the input frequency to this repeater. And depending on what signal strength you see on your S meter, please report that to us. K2IVX, India Victor X-ray. Len of Limark is the man who collects that information, but the Interference Committee, Limark, there's various ways you can report what you hear. So how strong is the signal when you hear a disruptive signal? We'd like to know about that. Now, let's talk about parasitic suppression and what it's really all about. In the case of real good high-power tube amplifiers, the plate tank circuit that you set up, in your case it might be a Pi network, it's got the C1 capacitor, an inductor, and a C2 capacitor. In other words, if you saw the schematic diagram, it literally looks a little bit like the Greek letter pi. The first capacitor is a vertical capacitor. The choke between the two is horizontal, and the second capacitor is another choke. When you adjust those two capacitors and the choke just right, you get an impedance match between the tube and the 50-ohm output. The actual impedance of your vacuum tube plate circuit might be, let me pick a number, 3,000 ohms, and that Pi network does the impedance inversion and resonance. If, for instance, you're on the 80-meter band, you might set it for 3.75 megacycles of resonance, and then simultaneously, by selecting those three components correctly, you're doing the impedance match from the plate, 3,000-ohm resistance, out to the transmission line, which is a 50-ohm impedance. Let me drop. And as the schematic diagram, that looks like a perfect circuit and everything should be hunky-dory. Now, in the case of the real world, the tube itself has got significant physical length within the structure of the vacuum tube. There's a certain lead length that goes to that plate circuit. There's a certain lead length that goes to that cathode, and so on. So even though you're using the amplifier on 3.75 megacycles, in my particular example, unbeknownst to you, the extra stray inductance and stray lengths that are within the tube could, because of the tube's gain, represent another resonant circuit at, let me pick a number, 150 megacycles. So the possibility exists that the tube is giving you quite a bit of gain at 3.7 megacycles where you're using it. At the exact same time, it's breaking into oscillation at 150 megacycles. Parasitic oscillations, when they occur, the vast majority of the time, they're on a much higher frequency. So now let's talk about what a parasitic choke is. If in series with that plate circuit, I put a so-called parasitic choke, the parasitic choke usually consists of something like a 47-ohm resistor, a 2-watt resistor, or bigger in physical size than a 2-watt resistor, with a few turns of wire across it. And then the wire is making contact on both leads of the resistor. So in other words, as a schematic diagram, you've got a resistor in parallel with this few turns. The few turns in the ideal world represents an extremely high impedance at, say, 150 megacycles, where the parasitic oscillation might exist for that particular tube in that particular layout, whereas the choke itself across the 47-ohm resistor, the few turns, in theory is a very small inductive reactance, way down to 3.7 megs. So the whole idea of the parasitic choke is that it becomes a very lossy inductive structure at the high frequency, and it dissipates that energy by putting it into the resistor and turning it into heat. But the circuit, the parasitic choke, is supposed to have a very minor perturbation toward the normal operation at 3.7 megacycles, which in my example is, 30 or 50 times lower in frequency. So the compromise here is to have enough inductance at the frequency where parasitic oscillation could take place, but too little inductance at the real operating frequency. That's the ideal world. Let me drop. Now, at first you would say, common sense would lead you to believe that if I simply put a series inductor in series with the tube, and that inductor had a significant reactance at 150 megs and very little reactance at 3.7 megs, that it would work like a charm. Well, Mother Nature is a little bit more nasty than that. When you create a parasitic oscillation, about the only way you can kill the parasitic oscillation is to stop the feedback mechanism from having more than unity gain. Some kind of insertion loss, some kind of dissipation is required. That's the reason why the 47-ohm resistor is there. And you have to take that energy that would have oscillated at 150 megs, in my example, and make it so lossy now that the loop gain within the tube at that parasitic frequency is less than unity, and you kill the parasitic oscillation. Because you're putting a number of resistors in parallel and then wrapping a coil around the whole bundle, it is possible that your total inductance that you wound is a larger amount, because when you go to the appropriate page of Radio Amateur's Handbook, there's a curve in there under the RLC circuits. The first couple of chapters where they study inductive reactants and capacitor reactants, there's a equation in there where if you know the diameter of your coil of wire, the space in between the turns, and the length of the wire, and the number of turns, you plug in those variables to that formula, it tells you how many microhenries your choke is. And now you want those number of microhenries to have a significant inductive reactance at, say, 150 megacycles in my example, like maybe a couple of thousand ohms, but only a small number of ohms, way down to 3.7 megs, where your circuit is normally operating. And now that resistor should dissipate the energy that's across that choke so that oscillation can no longer build up. Let me drop. So the fact that your 47-ohm resistors were getting hot and burning up suggests one of two things. You either did have a serious parasitic oscillation that they were trying to suppress and didn't completely suppress it. It really was going on continuously, and therefore heating up the resistors continuously and burning them up. Or because you were winding the wire across a larger bundle of resistors, and since the inductance goes up something like square law with diameter of the wire, you had a lot more inductance of your particular parasitic choke than you desired, and therefore it's starting to move into the frequency region of 3.7 megacycles in my example, and therefore it's got a continuous voltage drop at 3.7 megs across your parasitic choke, and therefore the resistor is burning up. Simply raising the resistor until it no longer experiences too much heat might not be enough of a solution, Rich. There still is a possibility that you're still breaking into a parasitic oscillation. By way of a good spectrum analyzer, or the spectrum analyzer function of a service monitor, you could look at the frequency spectrum coming out of your transmitter by way of some kind of a sampling circuit, and you know what sampling circuits look like, something you put in the middle of the transmission line to take a little bit of a sniff of the signal that's going up the transmission line. You could therefore look to see if any harmonic or non-harmonically related, in other words, if I've got the transmitter running at 3.7 megs and I'm doing a sniffing job into, say, an oscilloscope or a spectrum analyzer, and I'm getting near full scale, I'm getting near full scale deflection on the spectrum analyzer at 3.7 megacycles, and then you scan from 3.7 megs all the way up to, let me pick a number, 3 gigahertz, and see if there's any other signal there that shouldn't be there coming out of your transmitter. And if there is, you want to start fiddling with parasitic suppressors to suppress that other frequency. And you got to do the experiment on 80 meters, 40 meters, 20 meters, and so on. So I think you see the principle. You're trying to, just a pure inductor wouldn't do it. You have to absorb the undesired energy to make sure that the feedback mechanism that creates the parasitic oscillation, sometimes it's called a Barkhausen oscillation, the flyback tubes, the horizontal deflection tubes that used to be used on television sets, used to also have this exact same problem. There they called it Barkhausen oscillation. As long as the tube has got gain and there's a resonant circuit somewhere, even though your eye doesn't see it, Mother Nature dictates that the tube is going to act upon it, if you know what I mean, Rich. Maybe that helps. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, it does help a lot, K2RIW, N2EO. It's kind of what I thought. Like you said, you're developing a high impedance of the parasitic frequency, you either drop, and then you drop across that coil, I guess it's a parasitic, you're dissipating it in the resistor. This is a 6 meter amp, as I said. So, and from what I've read, is that 3-500s have a tendency to oscillate at around 110 megacycles. So your example of 150 is not far off. Possibly I have a little too much inductance because it's only running at 6 meters. Like I said, the coil is, the amplifier is closed up. It's like maybe an inch diameter or less, 2.5 turns, and I used a silver-plated strap that I wound the coils out of. Your point about checking it on the spectrum analyzer is a good one. I don't know where I'll get a spectrum analyzer, but everything does look clean. I mean, I can tune to resonance. Let it recycle. I don't see a blip or a jump in plate current or grid current. With insufficient parasitic suppression, the grid current and plate current were going nuts. I mean, it looks very, very, very stable. In fact, with no load on the amplifier, none at all, and engaging the relay, which puts it into the from standby bias into idle current, there's no instability. So it seems to be unconditionally stable as far as that type of oscillation. Anyway, Dick, thank you very much. I'm building one here for Barry and 2MB, so possibly on his, I'll try experimenting with a smaller amount of inductance and see if we can use a 47-ohm resistor. That might be all it is. Maybe too much inductance at 50 megahertz. Back to Ned and 2EL.
There's a couple of more pieces of information I should be giving you here, Rich. He used a great big silver-plated strap for the coil that goes around the parasitic suppression resistor. And there you're fighting yourself. The whole idea of the parasitic suppressor is that it should be a lossy network. Therefore, wrapping it out of wire that's thick enough to handle the current is the right way to go, because you're trying to create loss, obvious by the 47-ohm resistor you're putting there. You're fighting the system. You're putting a lossy resistor, but then you're making a low-loss coil. And so you're doing two things in the opposite direction. I don't recommend that. Second of all, now that I know that, yes, it's a 6-meter transmitter, and the oscillation, if you get it, is at 110 megs, the frequency ratio there is very small, and therefore the normal design of a parasitic suppressor troche becomes a lot more difficult. Let me drop. If that amplifier was normally operating on 80 through 10 meters and you had a properly designed parasitic suppressor choke on that amplifier, that exact same parasitic suppressor choke, when you start using the amplifier at 6 meters, what is that now, twice as high a frequency, all of a sudden the total amount of inductor reactance of that parasitic suppressor goes up, the amount of voltage drop across it increases. Therefore, it becomes lossy at your operating frequency, even if there is no parasitic oscillation. So, in your case, probably a redesign is required, a compromise is required, a smaller number of turns, a smaller diameter of turns. But I would try to keep using the 47-ohm resistor. Going up to a 1,400-ohm resistor, just because it runs cold, doesn't mean you're going to be getting enough suppression. But as you can see, because the frequency ratio between your possible oscillation and your real frequency of operation, 6 meters, that ratio is getting so small, designing that choke correctly becomes more difficult. But I know you can do it by the amateur cut and dry technique. You'll find it now that you know what you're looking for. And even if you don't have access to a spectrum analyzer or a spectrum analyzer function of a service monitor, you might have a scanner receiver in the house that can operate from, let's say, 20 megs to 200 megs and so on. By using the scanner receiver in the right kind of a power sampling circuit, you would be able to find out by scanning across all those frequencies. Not as convenient, but if you're willing to spend the time, you can find out whether or not there is a parasitic oscillation on either a harmonic or a non-harmonic frequency. Either one is possible. You now know a little bit more of what you're looking for, Rich. Please come back as you do these further experiments and let us know what you find. Next person who signed in was Steve, KC2 Quebec, Foxtrot Juliet. Go right ahead, Steve. I'm K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. Everyone on the net, wish everyone a happy Hanukkah and Merry Christmas today. My question today is about a dip meter, a venerable piece of equipment that was mentioned a lot when I was a kid, first getting interested in ham radio, and most of them didn't hear it mentioned too often. But I finally found one at a ham fest, and I know it's to the
oscillator's working because I can pick it up on the frequency counter and on the oscilloscope through a coupling link from the coils, but I can't seem to get it to work to actually dip a circuit. So I'm wondering what I'm doing wrong or what I might be looking at other than the fact that the dimmer is in fact oscillating when I should look at the first wave function.
Yeah, before I proceed, Steve, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. The grid dip meter that you're using, maybe it's a Heathkit, maybe it's a Millen. Those are the two most popular brands, Heathkit and Millen, way back in the dark ages of the 50s and 60s when they were popular. Usually there's a meter movement on the front of the unit, and usually there's a potentiometer you can turn in order to set the meter somewhere in the middle of its range. So, first of all, are you able to adjust the potentiometer when the grid dip meter is running and at least get the meter to move somewhere in the middle of its range, or is it starting off pegged to the left or pegged to the right? Give me that information first, Steve. Over to you, Steve, K2RIW.
Okay, the meter is an ICO. ICO, and it's actually AC line powered. It has one single tube, I believe. From looking at this schematic. And yes, I do get the full scale deflection of the meter by adjusting the potential geometer. May have needed to be kind of near one end extreme of the potentiometer to get that. So maybe that's indicative. Over.
Does the meter move upscale when you turn the potentiometer clockwise? And when you're saying you're using one extreme of that potentiometer. If it does move upscale when you turn the potentiometer clockwise, are you using that potentiometer near the maximum clockwise position? Is that what you're saying, Steve? Go ahead. KC2, Quebec, Foxtrot, Juliet. Are you there, Steve?
Okay, sorry. I was having a little trouble with EchoLink here for a second. Yes, that's correct. It's towards the full position of the potentiometer to get it to deflect.
Are you able to deflect the meter almost all the way over to the right? Over to you, Steve.
Yes, I can get full deflection on it. But again, to make it go forward almost all the way to the limit of the potentiometer, it does go full scale.
Okay. Everything you've told me so far sounds good, Steve. Sounds like your machine is operating. You've measured it on the counter. You're able to adjust the meter. And the fact that you're using almost all of the potentiometer range, that could be a red herring, a false alarm, if you know what I mean. Now, I'll give you a little bit of a theory of operation, and I'll tell you what to look for. The whole theory of operation of a grid dip meter is that that coil sticking out of the top, and you select the coil for what frequency range you want. That coil has, let's assume now you're making a measurement at 50 megacycles, and you choose the right coil, and you set the dial somewhere near 50 megacycles, what you expect. You adjust the potentiometer until the meter is, let me pick the number, 3/4 of full-scale deflection, like you deflect the meter to the 75% point. Now, if you had an inductor and a capacitor across each other making a resonant circuit, and that resonant circuit is sitting all by itself on a wooden table or on a foam block, and you bring the grid dip meter coil of the grid dip meter close so that the coil of the capacitor inductor sitting on your wooden bench, let's say the axis of that coil is north-south, and you bring the coil out of the grid dip meter nearby, so it also is axis north-south, and you make the two collinear, and you bring them close to each other. Now, as you swing the frequency dial on the grid dip meter, let's assume that your particular circuit resonated at 52 megacycles, and as you swing the frequency dial on your grid dip meter, and you sweep through 52 megacycles, you should see a dip on the grid dip meter. In other words, as you sweep through that frequency, the Dawson valve movement, the movement will move toward the left, and as you rock it back and forth, you can find the bottom of that valley, so to speak. And in order to make the measurement accurate, you then start backing away so that there's less and less sensitivity. You get more and more frequency accuracy when you do that. And now you choose a number of inches between the meter on your grid dip meter, the coil on your grid dip meter, and the LC coil sitting on the table. You choose the right distance so you can just barely see the meter deflect to the left as you sweep across that frequency. Now you're really measuring the resonant frequency. What's going on? The magic of resonance is that energy will couple. Your grid dip meter is truly oscillating, in my example, at 52 megacycles. The inductor and capacitor across each other, sitting on the wooden table or on the foam block, also resonate at 52 megacycles. And when the two circuits are close to each other in physical distance, close to each other in frequency of operation, energy gets coupled from the grid dip meter oscillator into that coil and capacitor combination sitting on the bench. Even though it's not connected to anything, it absorbs energy and dissipates it. Because there's now energy being sucked out of the grid dip meter, its amplitude of its oscillation decreases. Therefore, the rectification going on inside shows a smaller amount of DC voltage. Therefore, the meter that you're looking at starts deflecting to the left. So it takes a little bit of practice to know how to use one of these things, but it sounds to me like you're in the beginning of that operation. The possibility exists, as I see it, Steve, that the particular circuit you were holding your grid dip meter near, either that circuit was too well shielded, it was too far away, the coils, the axis of each of the two coils were not parallel to each other, they may have been at right angles so that there was no coupling, or maybe you just didn't hit the exact frequency of resonance. You could look through all of your parts. You've got spare parts that are in your junk bin, so to speak. Choose an inductor and or capacitor. By way of the reactance charts that are in the Radio Amateur's Handbook, you can select a resonant frequency. In other words, you might look through your junk box and find a 0.5 microhenry choke. And I'm just giving now a crazy example that may not be accurate, but a 0.5 microhenry choke, because it's marked there. You look at the reactance curves out of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, and you find out that if you put a 50 picofarad capacitor across it, it'll resonate at 50 megacycles, in my example. And then you decide that, okay, that's a combination that should resonate. I solder the two together in parallel and put them on the wooden table or on the foam block, and then I go and measure with the grid dip meter, do I see that frequency of resonance? So the possibility exists that you may not have hit the right resonant frequency of the circuit that you were measuring, therefore you got no reaction, or it also takes some practice to know what to look for. As you tune the dial of a grid dip meter, you will get a slow, continuous drifting of the meter. In other words, the grid dip meter, maybe it decides it likes to oscillate with a greater amplitude down at 50 megacycles and not quite as good a amplitude at 100 megacycles. So that as you slowly tune the dial from 100 to 50, from 50 megacycles to 100 megacycles with nothing near it, the dial will slowly move to the left, a very slow fall off of current versus dial tuning. That's normal operation of the grid dip meter. When you really hold it near a resonant circuit, that dip when you see it is very sharp. Approximately 1 megacycle wide instead of 50 megacycles wide of the natural characteristic of the grid dip meter itself. Well, does that make some sense, Steve? KC2, Quebec, Foxtrot, Juliet, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Oh, yes, it makes perfect sense, and I went through every test that was described in the manual, every different possible way, test, even testing crystal that was marked with it. I couldn't for the life of me get it to give a dip. I did definitely see what you're talking about, the reduction in the grid current there as you tuned around. But during everything, I just couldn't get it to show me a dip. And, the only thing perhaps I could think of whether is it possible that the single tube unit is old, maybe not oscillating strongly enough. So I can pick it up on the counter and the scope is just simply not enough to do it, but I really did try it with all kinds. kinds of coupling and circuits and every permutation I could think of. Over.
N2EO.
Rich recognized. I can hear the second Rich. No, stop worrying, Steve. It's like saying, can my wife be half pregnant? The answer is no. She's either pregnant or she's not pregnant. There's nothing in between. A grid dip meter either oscillates or it doesn't oscillate. If the tube was getting old and low in gain and whatever, it wouldn't oscillate quite as enthusiastically. But if it oscillates at all, and you can pick it up with a frequency counter and an oscilloscope and see the current change as you turn the dial, you're in operation. When you put it across a real inductor and capacitor, you'll see a real dip. In the case of measuring the frequency of oscillation of a crystal, that is an art form. That's a lot more difficult. The guys who measure crystal frequency resonance, let me drop, have learned that you have to put just the right number of turns of a coil across the two pins of the crystal and making good contact to it. You have to put just the right size coil across it and couple your grid dip meter to that coil just the right way in order to measure the frequency of resonance of a crystal. A crystal is a little bit difficult to measure, particularly if it's a harmonic crystal. I mean, your crystal might be operating on the third harmonic and it's stamped on its cover 30 megacycles, but the fundamental frequency of the crystal might really be 10 megacycles. And if you were doing a grid dip operation at 10 megs, you'd see a nice dip at 30 megs. It's there, but you might not see it. So measuring a crystal is a lot more difficult. As I said, it's a bit of an art form. I bet your Rich has run into problems like this. N2EO, how well have you been able to measure crystal oscillating frequencies? K2RIW, you got it, Rich.
The K2RIW TechNet Limog N2EO. I just pulled out my grid dip meter. I haven't used this a lot, but it's probably the same one he's got, a Model 710 ICO. I think he said he had an ICO. You know, Dick, this has a switch on a mark, oscillator, position one, and the other position is diode. Silly question. I hope he had it in the oscillator position. And I have used it to measure crystals. Like you say, you have to put a small coil, a couple of turns, whatever, between the two pins of the crystal, and, you know, put the coil close to the coil of the grid dip close to the coil across the crystal, and you will see a pronounced dip, but maybe you may have hit on it, Dick. If he's looking at, say, like, you know, I'm into the vintage stuff, so I'll use that as an example when we got a drop. If he had a crystal for 2 meters or 6 meters, and he's trying, well, in this case he did say 6 meters, that could actually be an 8 megacycle crystal, because, They triple in the oscillator to 24 megs, and then they have a doubler. So, you know, it could be misleading. The crystal could be marked 50.25 and 8 something megahertz. Back to net, N2EO.
So, as you can tell, Steve, there are at least two possible pitfalls here. Number one, you want to make sure that it's in the oscillator mode, the slide switch of your ICO, as opposed to the diode mode. The diode mode means that you can also use the grid dip meter as a passive wave meter. You can hold it near a oscillating circuit or a transmitter and find out what frequency is coming out of it by using it in the diode mode. But in the grid dip meter mode, the oscillator mode, you should see these effects that we're seeing. Where you did see the needle drift as you tune high and low, it does sound like you were in the grid dip meter mode. So, in the case of a 6 meter transmitter, sometimes the crystal itself is not operating on 6 meters; it's operating on 8 megacycles, and the various multiplication stages of the transmitter are multiplying that 8 megacycle crystal frequency all the way up to 50 megacycles, in which case your grid dip meter will not show a response at 50 megacycles. It'll only show a response at 8 megacycles on that crystal. As you make these further measurements and experiments, Steve, please come back and tell us what you find, because I guarantee other people have listened to what you're going through, and you're helping educate all of us. KC2, Quebec, Foxtrot, Juliet, K2LIW in the TechNet. You got it, Steve.
Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, no, it's definitely in the oscillator mode because, as I say, I got picked it up on the frequency counter and the scope and saw changes. I changed the frequency, et cetera. So, no, it was clearly oscillating. I guess your pregnancy analogy was unfortunate because the problem seems to be my technique. I will, like Woody Allen, go and practice a lot when I'm alone. So thanks, everybody, for the information, and I'll let you know what I find out once I get back home and experiment a little more. I'm pretty sure it is a 710 ICO.
Very fine, Steve. Good luck with that project, and let us know what you find. Okay, the next person who signed in was somebody I talked to very briefly this week, and that was Jim. Kilo Delta 2 Baker Hotel Yankee. According to the FCC records, you can see by going to QRZ.com, it appears that James is a very brand new amateur. I think his license became effective on December 12th. And if I know the FCC, it became effective on December 12th. And then they mailed it to him, and it probably didn't get into his hands until a few days later. So, and I think I was possibly the fourth person you've talked to with your brand new license a few days ago this week, Jim. You're allowed to ask any question you like, and welcome to Ham Radio. Kilo Delta 2, Baker, Hotel Yankee. You've got it, Jim. Wait for the four beeps. K2LIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
All right. Thanks, Dick. I have a question about satellites, which I was talking to you about earlier. You need... satellite signals are circularly polarized, so could I just use a regular Yagi beam antenna, or do I need some kind of special antenna? Because I was looking on the internet and I saw some videos of people just using regular Yagis, but I remembered that you saying that it needed to be circularly polarized.
There was sort of a yes and a no question to that one, Jim. If the particular satellite you're talking to has an uplink that is circular polarized and or a downlink that is circular polarized, and if the antennas that you're using for uplink and downlink are also circular polarized, you'll get the highest possible performance. But buying or building a circular polarized antenna is almost twice as difficult as a linear polarized antenna. Many, many amateurs have used simple, ordinary, linear polarized antennas on the uplink, on the downlink, or both, and it works. And depending on the particular characteristics of the satellite, if the satellite was somewhat linear, or if it's not a pure circular polarization transmission from the satellite, because almost all of these satellites use something that's called, let me drop. Almost all of these satellites use something that's called spin stabilization. In other words, at the instant the satellite was released from its booster rocket into space, a spring spun it, and it's now rotating like a top at some number of revolutions per minute. The reason they do that is that it now acts like a gyroscope that allows it to keep the exact same orientation in space. And because of that spin stabilization, let's assume that your particular satellite spins 4 revolutions per minute in my example. And if the satellite was a little bit linear in its polarization coming out of its transmission, out of its antenna, and if your antenna was also linear polarized, then 4 times per minute as the satellite rotates, the main axis of the signal coming out of the satellite, the polarization axis, would be copolarized with your antenna for a while, and then at right angles to that. The net result is that as you listen to the satellite signal and you watch your S-meter, you'd see the S-meter going up and down at the rate that the satellite is rotating. They call that the spin QSB. They got a lot of names for it, WOW, and so on. So if you're using a linear polarized antenna, you'll see more of that signal strength jumping up and down as the satellite rotates. The circular polarized antenna will take that effect out almost entirely. But it's a lot more work to build a circular polarized antenna. Let me drop. And And the sad news is that even if you were using a perfectly circular polarized antenna, during the time that the satellite is close to the horizon and you're getting a ground bounce signal as well as the direct signal, or because the signal is quite low on the horizon and you're looking through vertically polarized trees that don't have any leaves on them, or you're looking through buildings, what I'm getting at is the local environment under certain conditions can take a beautiful circular polarized signal coming out of your antenna or coming out of the satellite, and as that signal gets sifted through those buildings, sifted through those trees, or bouncing off that ground, the signal is no longer a beautiful circular polarized signal. A clockwise circular polarized signal that bounces off the ground becomes counterclockwise. That's just one of the crazy things about circular polarization. So the average person in the beginning who asked the question, should I put forth all the effort to make the CP? And I think the answer is no. You're allowed to crawl now and walk later and run later yet, if you know what I mean. In other words, get the system operational, use it with whatever equipment you've got, and then slowly improve it. That's the way many amateurs do it. It doesn't have to be a Cadillac the first time you set it up to do satellite operation. You might have some more questions, but I hope that helps a little bit, Jim. Kilo Delta 2, Baker Hotel Yankee, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thanks so much. That really helps a lot. I have one more quick question. I'm going up to Massachusetts this season, and I'm going to bring my radio. I was going to try some Simplex there, but if there's no Simplex, I was going to use a repeater. If I were to use a repeater, but then I combined a CTC SS signal within my signal, not for that repeater, but for a different repeater, in other words, could I hit two repeaters? Or would the second CTC SS signal interfere with the first repeater?
Yeah, when it comes to, I'm going to go back for a second. When it comes to the satellite operation, using the right kind of an antenna with what methods of aiming the antenna, in other words, with the right computer program, you know where the satellite is, you know that at this hour of the day it's supposed to be 45 degrees above your horizon to the south, and you aim your antenna 45 degrees above the horizon due south, so your antenna, your Yagi antenna, that's what you're using, is aimed right at the satellite. That'll give you the best operation for listening and transmitting to it. So aiming the antenna is a bit more important than worrying about circular polarization. Now, when it comes to the CTCSS, which most amateurs call it PL, the old days it used to be called private line, PL, so they call it the PL tone, because it's a lot easier to pronounce PL tone instead of CTCSS. But it's really the same thing. Let me drop. The whole idea of those tones, the PL tone, for instance, like the repeater you're listening to right now, except for during the TechNet. Let me drop. Hello, 1-2. Yeah, I just decided to do a transmission right now with my PL tone turned off, and there's my PL tone turned on. So the way this repeater is set up, during the TechNet only, to my knowledge, no PL tone is required. The rest of the time, a PL tone is required. And the tone must be a weak signal at 136.5, as if it came out of the microphone, but it's not. It's a 136 hertz signal, 136 and a half hertz signal. The repeater looks for that tone and says, yes, that is a valid signal intended for the New York City area. Therefore, I, the repeater, I'm going to turn on my repeater and turn on my transmitter and repeat that signal. And if, for instance, some other tone is being used in Connecticut, and you take, for instance, the Torrington, Connecticut repeater is on the exact same frequency, 146.85 megacycles. However, that repeater, 146.85 megacycles, that repeater uses a different tone. So a person in Torrington, Connecticut, during a band opening, using his particular tone, will open up the Torrington repeater, and the repeater down here on Long Island, in theory, will have no response. So each one of these repeaters, when they are using a PL tone, has a characteristic frequency that you must use to open that particular repeater. That tone will open only that local repeater and no other. You could, if you want to. Let me drop. If you're standing on a tall mountain in Torrington, Connecticut, Mount Holyoke, for instance, where you've got good coverage from there down to Long Island, and you want to talk to your Long Island buddies, you could dial your handy talkie to 136.5 hertz of PL tone, transmit on 146.85 megacycles during the time the Torrington repeater is not being used. Now you stand on top of that mountain, you transmit that tone, and in theory, if the band is in good operation, your buddies down here on Long Island will hear you, even though you're way up there in Torrington, Connecticut, alongside of their particular repeater. However, if somebody decides to use their particular repeater and with the proper PL tone turns it on, because that signal is on the exact same frequency and so close to you when you're up there in Torrington on that mountain, you're going to hear that local repeater. You won't hear the one on Long Island anymore. That's the reason why I say you could only do that when their particular repeater is not being used. In general, you cannot turn on more than one repeater at a time. In theory, you could put two tones into your, by modifying the design of your transmitter, you could put two tones into it, and you could turn on more than a repeater at the same time. Almost nobody does that. There's very little advantage in doing it, and I don't recommend it. Maybe that helps a little bit, Jim. KD2BHY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Actually, I have no more questions because that was so explanatory. This is KD2BHY, that's the next.
Okay, with a compliment like that, I'll keep paying you, Jim, to make those statements. That's a bit of a joke. If I keep paying you, will you keep saying those compliments? That's one of the jokes I've often used, and the people who have heard me a lot of years are getting tired of hearing it by now. I think I've gone down the list of everybody who had a question who signed in during the first hour of the TechNet, but let me double-check. Is there somebody out there? Because we're not quite finished with the first hour yet. Anyone out there that I missed, or anyone else with another quick question, give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
K2MU.
Kilowatt 2, Mike Uniform. K2RIW, I'm trying to remember when you signed in last week. That was Bernie. Go right ahead, Bernie. K2RIW.
Good evening, Dick. Yeah, that's right. Bernie, K2MU here. Quick question. I'm actually mobile, handy-talkie by the Cross Neck Bridge mobile. I'm waiting to pay the toll. My question is, why can we receive FM receiver? That's all. Back to you.
Okay, you had a very brief dropout, Bernie. How can I receive FM on a blank receiver? Want to run that one by again? Go ahead.
You know what, stand by one. I'm sorry, I gotta pay.
Sounds like you're going to the toll booth, paying the toll, and we'll stand by for a couple of seconds while you do that. And maybe the guy can hear me, and I hope the money you're giving him is real good money. You're not giving him those homemade dollar bills there, are you, Bernie? K2 Mike Uniform, when you get a chance. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, I wish I had some of those to pay with, but I don't. No, I gave him the real money. I hope you're copying me okay. You should be, because I'm pretty much on the Throgsnet Bridge now. Anyway, my question is, how is it that it's possible to copy FM on an AM receiver? I'm just not sure how that works. I noticed that I have no problem copying FM on the AM receiver. Back to you.
It turns out I spent the first 10 years of my VHF ham radio life doing exactly that. I had built myself a homebrew, frequency synthesized, 6-meter transmitter, and as a method of modulation, I used narrowband FM. And each of the people I talked to, I would tell them to use their receiver in the AM mode and slope detect. In other words, tune a little bit high or a little bit low of the center frequency, and then you would hear my audio. As you know, when you tune your receiver across a steady-state signal, like somebody puts a brick on the crystal on the key, it transmits a continuous steady tone, and you operate the dial on your receiver, As you tune across the signal, you'll watch the signal strength meter go up, peak out at the top, and then as you go out the other side, you'll see it go back down again. So therefore, if you tune the receiver halfway between the peak and the valley, so to speak, so you're doing slope detection.